This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
In the Haggadah we're going to read on Wednesday night, Baruch Shenosan Toiro Lamo Yisrael Baruchu. Blessed be he who gave the Torah to his people Israel, blessed be he. Keneged Arbo Avonim Dibro Toiro. The Torah spoke about four sons, the famous four sons. What is the connection? The Meshech Chochma explains that we're praising the Ribbono Shel Olam who gave us such a Torah which is meaningful to all four types of people. That the Torah is not restricted to particular people who are able to make sense of it, and particular Jews who are able to make sense of it. All the four, as different as they are, the Chochom and the Rosho and the Tam and the Sheni, the Elisho, each is so enormously different from the other, yet the same Torah appeals to all of them. They're all able to make sense of the same Torah. They're all able to understand the same Torah. The method of them being able to understand the same Torah is clearly, as the Haggadah continues, through the type of questions they ask. They can each ask questions, and through their questioning, they're able to make sense. And that was the subject of my shiur tonight, the duty to question. Duty spelled D-U-T-Y. We're going to see that the power of questioning is fundamental to all levels of understanding. The Torah provides an enormous source of unlimited knowledge and thinking, concepts and values, and not everybody can get to it all. But we each have a chelik, we each have a dimension of the Torah which we're able to understand. But without using the questioning process, we're not going to make it. That's the most fundamental of all procedures in the learning process, is the questioning process. And on Pesach we see a great deal of emphasis at the Seder being placed on questioning. We've got the four questions in the beginning, and then we've got the four sons, but more important than that, there are so many halachas which we carry out on Seder night, which for which the reason is given to encourage the children to ask questions. We do all sorts of funny things. We bring the soda plate onto the table, and we take the soda plate off the table, and we dip when we're not supposed to dip, and we wash our hands, and then we do all sorts of crazy things. And the reason in the halacha given is to get the children to ask questions. And that's very strange. That concept is strange, that we do odd things to make them ask questions. Is that the only meaning? So we could just as well have been told to do cartwheels and to do all sorts of silly things, so to get the children to ask why. Surely there's enough to ask about, not still to have to create reasons for questions. But perhaps we'll understand that better a little bit further on. In order to understand this questioning procedure, I'm going to analyze with you the first two questions and answers. The Chochom and the Rosho. The wise man and the wicked man. The wise man asks, Chochom mahu oimer? Mo ha'edos v'hachukim v'hamishpotim asher tzivo Hashem elokeinu eschem. It's a pasuk from the Torah in Dvarim. He asks, what are the statutes, what are the Eidos, it's difficult to translate these words because the translation is meaningless. Let's rather define them. Eidos is that part of the Torah which deals with the history, with the historic and the philosophic aspects. The beginning of the Torah, the story of the flood and of Avraham and of Yitzchok and of Yaakov and of the going into Mitzrayim and coming out of Mitzrayim, all that is the Eidos. The Chukim are statutes. They are mathematically defined laws, the philosophy for which is no factor in their understanding. We don't know, very often we don't know the reasons, we have no understanding. The Mishpatim are the laws of justice, the balance in the laws which work, where there's a working of laws against and with one another, and harmonies of justice are created. So that includes the interpersonal laws and so on. What, asks the Chacham, are these Eidos, Chukim, and Mishpatim which Hashem, our God, commanded you? And you also should say to him Kehilchus HaPesach, about the laws of Pesach, Ein Matirin Achar HaPesach Afikoyma. Your answer to him is that after you've eaten the Korban Pesach, in those days they used to eat the sacrifice itself, and Mimir Tzashem, one day we'll be doing that again too. We eat the sacrifice of Pesach. Today, in order to remember it, we do a few things. The one is we have the chicken wing on the plate, the Zera is on the Seder plate to remember the Korban Pesach. And the other thing that we do is at the end of the Seder we have the Afikoman. The Afikoman is the last thing we taste, which is the time in the meal when the Korban Pesach would have been eaten. And after the Korban Pesach, we eat nothing else. That's the last thing. And you should teach him the halachas of Pesach, Ein matirim achar Pesach afikoman, that you don't eat anything after the Korban Pesach. That's the last thing that stays in your mouth. Now, at our Seder, we usually find that when we get to this point, we spend a couple of hours here. Because there's nothing so apparently absurd as this in the entire Haggadah. The man asks an intelligent question, he's a Chacham after all, he asks, Moha Eidus, the Chukim, the Mishpatim. What are, meaning, what are the reasons for the Eidus, the Chukim, the Mishpatim? A fine question, he classifies, he defines, there are Eidus, I understand, there are Chukim, I understand, there are Mishpatim, I understand. What is the reason? Teach them to me. Give me a sense of meaning in all these different aspects and all these different elements of the Torah. And what do we say to him? Ein matir nachar Pesach afikoman. You're not allowed to eat after the Korban Pesach. Next question, please. What does it mean? What does it mean? But there's one thing more strange than this answer given to this question. And that is that in most Siddurim that take place, people read through this without stopping. This is the question, this is the answer, Rosh Mahumah, Mahavid, and so they go on. That's even more peculiar. Because to encounter something absurd is already quite a jar to the personality. But to encounter people accepting the absurd, that's even more weird. There's nothing more weird than that. And that we see as a theme in the whole Seder table. We do weird things and we want people not to accept it. That's what we want people to ask. And people don't ask. It's as I said recently in another shiur, it's quite tragic in the world of Torah that standards in so many areas have dropped. And somebody gets up to give a Dvar Torah at a Sheva Brochas or at a Suda or whatever and talks nonsense, really superficial and meaningless nonsense. And everybody says you should care afterwards. And if the Chofetz Chaim would get up and would give the most wonderful shmuz, they would also say you should care the same way. It doesn't make any difference. It's come to a point where there are low expectations, where the Olam, where the public doesn't expect high intellectual standard from Rabbonim, from Tamidei Chachomim. They expect nonsense, they expect nonsense. It doesn't shake them, it doesn't jar them. If a professor would get up and talk in his subject on the standard that many people get away with talking in Torah, he would be thrown out, he would be laughed out of town. And yet Tamidei Chachomim can get away with talking such superficial and sometimes nonsensical things. And that they do it, I understand. Why do they do it? They haven't got time to prepare properly. But what I don't understand is that people accept it. Because if people didn't accept it, they would find the time to prepare. It wouldn't take them very long to find the time to prepare. There has to be a pressure from a society. There has to be a demand for standards. And this, that one can get away with doing all sorts of weird things, it's very, very strange. I have the feeling that if I, without Sibyl, of course, but with many people, if one invited them home, and instead of making kiddush and a glass of wine, one did some other hocus pocus first. I don't know what. Put a top hat on the table, turned it upside down, pulled a rabbit out of it, do whatever you want. People would sit there seriously, shuckling away. The fact that it's absurd doesn't seem to bother anybody. People don't pick up inconsistencies. They don't pick up things which are krum, things which are crooked, things which are wrong, things which are so stupid. Don't pick them up. As I said in the Shabbos HaGodol Shir, stupid things, you find the situation, you see how the halacha goes out of its way to require that at a Seudas mitzvah there is meat. It's part of the Seudas mitzvah, there must be meat there. To the extent that on the Yom Tov you're allowed to shecht in order to ensure that there's meat available. We don't do it today, we don't need to do it. But that's what was allowed. Shechita is allowed to make sure that there's meat. That's why we're allowed to cook on Yom Tov. And what do we do now? Now you find a situation in this little village of Johannesburg that there are different people don't eat from each other's shechita. This one doesn't eat at this one, and this one doesn't eat at this one. So what do people do? If I'm having a Seudas mitzvah and I'm inviting friends from different groups, some eat this meat and some eat that meat, and so what do? Don't have meat at all. And I think that's the way out. So we'll have fish, fine, then everybody will eat. So what have I done? I have removed the Seudas mitzvah element. I have diminished the status of the whole Seuda in order to accommodate people with a Meshugashenkov. It's so odd, it's so absurd, but people accept it as normal. That's why, as I say, I have the feeling that one can get away with anything today. No matter how absurd, in fact, I'll go a step further, that the more absurd it is, the more attractive it is to people. The less it makes sense, the more weird it is, the more spiritual they think it must be. There's that kind of element. I've told you before that a couple of years ago I had to be in the United States and thereafter in Korea. And I was in the United States, and at that time Reverend Moon was doing very well. And I heard Reverend Moon speaking, and of course I couldn't understand a word because he speaks Korean. So I asked him, doesn't he speak English? They said, no, he doesn't speak any English. And he had millions of followers, young people, older people, millions, making millions of dollars as well. And then a week later I was in Korea, and I was being driven by a taxi driver past a huge square. And I said to him, what is the square used for? He said, it can hold a lot of people, public meetings. I said, how many people can it hold? He said, 1 million. It can seat 1 million people. I said, have you ever had an occasion where 1 million people have been seated? He said, once. And I said, what was that occasion? He said, Billy Graham came to speak. I said, Billy Graham came to speak. What language did he speak in? He said, in English. I said, of the 1 million people, how many understood Billy Graham? He said, nobody. 1 million people came to hear a man talk a foreign language that they can't understand. So in America they were flocking to hear Reverend Moon, and in Korea they were flocking to hear Billy Graham. What happens when Billy Graham is in America? Nobody goes. What happens when Reverend Moon is in Korea? They laugh at him. The more weird it is, the less easy it is to understand, the more hocus pocus, the more it attracts the religiously inclined. It must be religious, it must be spiritual if it doesn't make any sense. And that's very worrying, and the whole Seder is orientated to catch us out on that. And here's a perfect example. We're thrown right in the beginning with an intelligent question answered with the most weird, ridiculous answer. And people read on. So we're going to have to analyze that question and answer. Let's go first to the Rosh. Rosh Hashanah, what does the Rosh say? Mo ha'avoido hazo islochem. What is this avoida to you? This service. So he picks, not from the Eidos, he's not asking about the stories of the Chumash, he understands them. Nor is he asking about the Mishpotim, the justice laws, the laws of interpersonal behavior, he accepts them too. It's the avoida. Davening, korbonos, the Pesach service, what's it all about? What is it for you? There the Agoda says, Ulefi shehitzi es atzmui min haklol kofa b'ikor. And since he has removed himself from the general community, he has denied the essentials of Yiddishkeit. The af ato hakhe yeshinov, and you also, I think the English translates that as blunted his teeth. Is that right? How about the English says? Sorry, set his teeth on edge. I have no clue what it means in the English. I don't know what it means in the Hebrew either. But it means give him a hak. You give him what for? And say to him, Ba'avu ze also Hashem li b'tzeisim imitzvayim. You answer also with a pasuk from the Torah, Hashem did this for me when I came out of Egypt, li v'loy loy, for me and not for him, ilo ayoshem loy anigol, if he were there, he would not have been redeemed. It's interesting that we switch into the third person here. We don't talk to him, we talk about him. That's the way we deal with the Rosh. He asks the question, we turn to our friends and say, Hashem took us out of Egypt. If he was there, he wouldn't be. He wouldn't have been. All of a sudden you start talking in the third person, which is an interesting technique of dealing with such individuals. But we need to understand who this Rosh is, what he is. And also we need to understand that surely we must answer his question. What's wrong with the question? The question is quite a legitimate question. It's not that dissimilar to the Chacham's question. He wants to know the meaning of the Avodah. Answer it. If not for him, let's answer it for ourselves. Then Hakei Shinov, then you can smite him if he doesn't want to accept the answer, if he doesn't show readiness, then do what you want with him, but at least answer the question. Now let's understand what his problem is, what this Rosh's problem is. Firstly, we note that he says, Ma ha'avido hazois lochem. What is this service to you? Now the Rosh said, the Chacham said something similar. What did he say? What are these statutes and laws and etc. and mishpatim which Hashem commanded you? But there are certain major differences. Firstly, the Chacham talks about Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem our God. Secondly, the posuk of the Chacham is quoted from Dvorim. Dvorim takes place shortly before they enter into the land of Israel. So the Chacham at that time, who asked the question at that time, was not at Sinai. He has got to learn the Torah from his Rabbeim. So he says, I want to know the Torah which God commanded you. That's the Torah I want to know. That's perfectly legitimate. Not only is it legitimate, but in that phrase lies his Chochmah. He says, I don't want to know Chidushim, I don't want to know new philosophies. I want to know what you learned from your teachers. That's what you must teach me. And that's an understanding of the authority of Torah, where Torah has its roots, where Torah has its essence. It's not a desire for novelty. It's not a desire for new systems and for new approaches and for new nothing. I just want to know authentically. What did Hashem tell you at Sinai? And the next generation will have to say, what did your fathers tell you that Hashem told them at Sinai? And the next generation will have to say, what did your fathers tell you that their fathers told them that their fathers were told at Sinai? And so it goes throughout history. Each generation is meant to be taught and told that which the previous generation was taught by its teachers. That's Torah. So the Chacham is quite legitimate. The Rosh comes from Shmos, Perik Yud Beis. That's the parasha of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So he's in the very midst of it and he says, what is this all to you? That's Rishus. What do you mean, what is it all to you? You're here too. It's all happening to you as well. What does this mean to us, you can say. But this, what does it mean to you, is very interesting. Firstly, as we mentioned, he pulls out the Avodah. So he's prepared to accept the Torah. Ten Commandments, fine. Everything fine, except for Shabbos maybe. The laws, interpersonal relationships, wonderful, no problem, I'm a humanist. Belief in God even, okay, believe in God, no problem with that. Eidah is the story of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, the story of Mitzrayim, all that is okay. It's only Avodah I have a problem with, the formal aspects of Yiddishkeit. And he goes further and he says, Ma ha'avodah hazois lachem, what is it to you? Implying, says the Beis Halevi, that he's not asking what is the purpose, what is the meaning of all this Avodah. That's not his question. He's not saying, explain the philosophy to me. He's saying, tell me why you still do it. That's what I want to know. I understand the philosophy of it. And understanding the philosophy of it, I don't know why you do it. What is the philosophy of it? What is he asking specifically about? He's sitting at the Seder table. Let's learn him in the Haggadah context now, not Torah context, in the Chumash context, but in the context of the Haggadah. He's sitting at the Seder table. And he says, what's all this? What are you doing this for? And then don't tell me the reasons. I know the Chumash, I know the reasons. But why are you doing it? He says, what does it mean to you? So we start telling, what should we answer him? Should we start telling him the reasons? That we keep it because Hashem took us out of Egypt, and we do the Korban Pesach. Why do we do the Korban Pesach? Because the Egyptians used to serve the lamb as an idol, as Mr. Brist. And we have to destroy that idol, and we have to show that we have no attachment to it, and that we believe and trust in the Ribbono Shel Olam only. All that aspect of it. Good. Are we going to tell him that? What's he going to answer? I know that. I know that. But my question is, today, what do you do it for? Are there still Egyptians today that worship sheep? This is a long time ago. It has no relevance today. Moha avodah azos lochem is a question of relevance, not a question of philosophy. There have to be two elements to make something meaningful. it has to have a reason, it has to have a philosophy to it, a meaning, and it has to have a relevance. If either are missing, then the thing becomes meaningless. There has to be purpose to it, and there has to be relevance to it. If you're going to give me purpose which is no longer relevant, then it remains meaningless. Meaningless in the context of the present. It might have been meaningful thousands of years ago. And that's what the Rosh is claiming. A very familiar sounding question it now becomes. Very familiar sounding question. Don't forget that Beis Halevi lived at the time of the beginning of the Reform movement, of the Enlightenment in Europe. And he saw mirrored in the Rosh, the claims which then Reform was coming up with. The then Reform was a different story from Reform today. Then Reform these were people who knew and who had learnt and who had studied, and this was the line they took. What does it mean to you today? What is its purpose today? This Rosh altogether, before we go any further, we have to look at him carefully. When one talks about the Reform movement, you know, evil is taking on an entirely new cloak today. We're living in a very exciting time because evil is changing its image totally. We're living in a time of mass communication and image building and all sorts of fancy things. And the Sultan's decided also to get into the act and to change his image. And we find it across the board in every area. One sees it in the area of Gorbachev, for example. New image, man of peace, disarmament. Different image altogether. A communicator, sophisticated, educated. One saw it already before then. One saw it already with the previous one, the one before the previous one. What, Andropov? Remember him? That was a long time ago. Andropov. He was already the civilized man who enjoyed good whiskey, classical music. Remember him? And people forgot so quickly that he used to be the head of the KGB. One doesn't become the head of the KGB if one's a sensitive, cultured person who enjoys music. It doesn't fit together. In fact, one doesn't become the head of state of the Soviet Union if one is that kind of person. It's totally disastrous. It's not possible. By nature, the person who reaches that position has to be a ruthless, conniving, scheming, brilliant person with a lot of grassroots support. Has to be, otherwise he doesn't get there. And people fall for it so quickly. Not only are we good at creating images, but we're good at falling for the very images that we create. And here the fellow comes along with a smile, with a new image, with a new story, and everybody's got their arms around him, rushing there to do business, to get involved, deals, disarmament. And it's all very serious. It's all very, very serious. As I think I mentioned already a couple of times, there was a conference in Miami about 6 months ago at which a senior Russian diplomat was present, and he got up to speak, and he said, among other things, "We are about to deliver the most fatal blow ever to the United States." And he held silence. And you could hear a pin drop in that room. And the American diplomats were going white with panic and worry. And then he continued, "We are about to remove your enemy from you. And you won't know what to do without an enemy." And I understood. That's it. When it was this relief. Very funny. But he was right. He knew exactly what he was saying. The most fatal blow. Remove the enemy, because it doesn't mean really removing the enemy. It means simply changing the image. Different image. That line was followed shortly afterwards by Arafat. All of a sudden, man of peace. The Arabs want peace. They want to live together with the Jews. No problem. We want to share the country. We don't want to drive them out. Anything, we're willing to talk to them. We're willing to stop terrorism. All of a sudden, Arafat realizes, probably prompting from Moscow, that the finest form of terrorism is to infiltrate the very society. That's the old trick of terrorism, to infiltrate. But now the terrorism has been more or less pinpointed and portrayed, and everybody's aware of it and everybody sees it. Now all of a sudden, It's not so easy to be a terrorist. It's not so fashionable to be a terrorist anymore. Now there's a finer form of terrorist. Appear like the enemy, but not just in uniform. Up till now, terrorism means dress like the enemy, but think and act like us. Now the chiddush in that side of the world is, don't just dress like the enemy. Act like them too, and think like them too, and speak like them too, until the point where they cannot tell the difference between you and us. Then you get them. That's when you do it. What is AIDS? Attack the body. With what? With the body itself, that the body can no longer distinguish between who is the enemy and who isn't the enemy. And the body starts seeing itself as the enemy eventually. When there is a confusion of boundary lines, of who belongs where, then there's a total destruction of self. And that's the understanding. And we're moving into that world where it's going to be reflected in disease, in economic problems, in political problems, in military problems. In every area there's going to be the same pattern of a change of tactic, where the enemy takes on the appearance of being a man of peace. We want shalom and so on. And that puts us in the most terrible position. So what does Israel do? Now the Arabs come along and say, we want peace. The Jews in America say, fantastic, that's what we've wanted for 40 years. Finally they see reason, and the Jews send delegations over to Arafat, and they drink with him and eat with him and be photographed with him and hug him and kiss him. And the Goyim in America say, the Jews seem to approve. No, that's fine, we seem to have solved the problem. We've just got to pressurize the Israeli government to agree. And what we're watching is step by step the annihilation of Israel in a way far more cunning and far more brutal than anything that has been attempted until this day, including the Six-Day War, the War of Independence, the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, the whole lot of them. Those wars didn't have much chance of success. This one has a chance of success. And we're facing enormous problems. Just as AIDS cannot be counted, so this cannot be counted except by MS, except by clear perception of the truth. And we're not living in a world where truth is really terribly important. And therefore there is no stopping this force. No stopping at all. Before I went over to America on my recent lecture tour, where one of the topics that I had to talk on was sanctions, the morality and ethics of sanctions as a method of punishment. And obviously various things were going to crop up. And I met with an expert, a South African expert on the ANC, among other people, in preparation for this trip. And he said to me, don't talk about terrorism and don't talk about the ANC being a terrorist organization, if I can give you some advice. And I said, why do you say that? I said, I thought that would go down very well, because Americans don't like terrorists. He said, you're right, Americans don't like terrorists, and very soon the ANC won't like terrorists either. It is becoming fashionable even for terrorists to talk negatively about terrorism. That's not the problem. There are other problems that we face. The problem is not terrorism anymore. That's becoming outmoded. That's going out of fashion. This business of bombing up civilian targets and landmines and all this thing, we're at the end of it. That phase in history is about to phase out. I'm sorry, the person I was talking to was not an expert on the ANC. The person I talked to was a criminologist, as they call him. A world-renowned expert on Russia. And he pinpointed this complete change in attitude. And it's affected as well Reform Jewish leadership. As you know, Reform Jews are people who, what can one expect? That's where they're educated, that's what they know, there's nothing one can do, and one has to make every effort to teach them and to be makariv them in whatever way we can. But Reform leadership, that's a different cup of tea altogether. Reform leadership knows, and it's a deliberate attempt to destroy the fundamentals of Yiddishkeit. That there's an interesting thing happening. Reform Jewish leadership is becoming frum. And this is one of the most dangerous things that have ever happened to orthodoxy in the Western world. Because in appearance-wise, just like the Russians love to, and just like the Arabs, the borders are becoming confused. What is it? And you'll find now Reform rabbis or Reform ministers go with their tzitzis out, and they're growing beards. Some of them are wearing kapotas on Shabbos already. And they're looking very prim. And there's a general effort to sell Reform Judaism as something which is very similar, except for a couple of little things which we've modernized and streamlined. It's virtually the same. That's the effort. Part of that same tendency to be metashtesh es hagvulos, to confuse the borderlines. Once the borderlines are confused, then you've got an AIDS principle, where from within the body will consume itself. You don't have to do anything. It will be so confused as to who's an enemy and who isn't, that it will just destroy itself totally. That's the Roshah. We have an insight written so long ago about what the Rosh is. Says the Rosh, the Eidos, wonderful, fine. The Mishpotim, wonderful. Even the Chukim, I understand the Korban Pesach and why it was brought. Only one thing. Today we don't need it anymore, that's all. Torah is wonderful, Yiddishkeit is wonderful, Korbanos, what a wonderful thing. Everything fantastic, just not today. Things have changed. That's the Rosh. What do we answer him? It appears that we don't answer him at all. But we have on this the famous Beis Halevi, who explains the answer, and we're going to use this answer to understand the whole principle of everything we're discussing this evening. Explains the Beis Halevi, what is the pasuk that we quote to him? Ba'avur ze oso Hashem li betzesi mimitzroim. You're mistaken, Rosha. You don't understand anything. You're questioning whether and why the reasons for these mitzvahs still apply today. What I want to tell you is that it is because of these mitzvahs that Hashem took me out of Egypt, not the other way around. You think God took me out of Egypt, and because of that we have to keep a Seder. And you believe that because the Egyptians worshipped a lamb and we had to undo all that and its effect upon us, that's why we have to bring a Korban Pesach. That's not so. Because the laws of the Korban Pesach were designed millennia before any Egyptian was designed. We're told that the Torah came long before the creation of the world. We know that Avraham Avinu kept Pesach. He ate matzah and he gave his guests matzah already. It was Pesach. So what was he eating matzah for? What was he keeping it for? His forefathers didn't come out of Egypt. They didn't have to bake their bread in a hurry so that the dough couldn't rise. Why did he bring a Korban Pesach? To undo the effects of Egyptian idol worship? There was no Egyptian idol worship in his day. We answer the Rosho. You think that the cause is Mitzrayim, is the episodes of Egypt, and the result, the effect, is Pesach. What I need to teach you is that the cause is Pesach, and the result was Egypt. Pesach is a value all on its own. It's a concept that stands all on its own and existed quite independently of Egypt. The Ribbono Shel Olam then brought the whole thing to take place, the whole story of Egypt and going into Egypt and coming out of Egypt, in order to give meaning to these chukim, to these statutes which we were observing, to this avodah, which we were observing long before that time already. So although there is a meaning and there is a philosophy, the cause is not the philosophy. The cause is the mitzvah. The result is the historic event which takes place later on. It's a different thing altogether. And with that, the Beis Halevi explains a medrash which says, a medrash in the beginning of Chukas, that says, there's a pasuk in Zechariah, v'hoyo b'yamahu lo yeh'oil yikoros v'kipoin, and the medrash explains, dvorim ha'mechusim michem b'olam hazeh, things which are unrevealed to you in this world, things which you don't understand in this world, asidim li yis tsofim ba'olam habo, are going to be uncovered. They will be perceived and understood in the world to come. Kahaden samiel the tzafo, and you will be like a blind person who is given his vision. Imagine a blind person who's been blind from birth, groping around, trying to find his way, trying to imagine what things are. So he builds up a picture in his mind of what the world must look like. Imagine if Chas v'Sholom you were blind and the only access you had was your hearing, your touching, smell, taste. That was the only way you could form an opinion of what's going on around you. Imagine the impression, the picture of the world that you would have. What the picture might look like. And imagine that all of a sudden you're given vision. How different it would appear. How totally different. There's this story, there's a lovely story written, I forget what it's called, about a blind man who marries a woman, and they build up a lovely relationship. And he really loves her, and she loves him, and they build up a wonderful relationship. And then a professor meets them, and finds that he feels he could cure the blindness of this man. And the worry that they go through during the slow process of retaining the eyesight. What will he think of her when he really sees her? He's built up this romantic image of her. What's he going to do when he really sees her? And I forget how the story goes, and one could write an equally fascinating story either way. That he sees her and loves her even more, if one wants it all to be fairy tale like, or one could write a tragedy, that he sees her and he sees all the flaws in her and that the relationship cracks up. Either story would be a fascinating work. And so the Medrash suggests that in Olam Habo, when things are clearer, we will have a perception of the world totally different to that which we have at the moment. So for example, it appears that chukim, statutes such as the Poradum, Red Heifer, we don't understand it at all. Funny laws, funny halachas about the Poradum that we can't relate to. Even things like that will be clarified in the Olam Habo. Time to come, we will understand it. There are reasons, and we'll understand the reasons, and we'll understand the principles. What does it all mean? Ask the Beis Halevi, that really isn't what the Posuk is talking about. The Posuk is talking about the Geula to come, the redemption to come. You will go along roads that you haven't seen before. But how does that reflect on the fact that we will then understand mitzvahs which we haven't understood before? Where does that come in the Posuk? Says the Beis Halevi, imagine the Jews before the time of Egypt. Comes Pesach time, 15th of Nisan. What do they have to do? 14th of Nisan. They have to bring a korban. Why? Who knows why? Must be a lamb, must be eaten whole, nothing must be left out. Why? Don't know why. Comes the night of the 15th, they've got to eat matzah. Why matzah? What are you going to answer to them? What you can't say, because our forefathers were in Egypt, and there's no such reason. So when Avraham Avinu, when Yitzchak asked Avraham, Father, why are we eating matzah tonight? What could he answer? Eating matzah tonight because it's a mitzvah in the Torah. That's all it is. Mitzvah, that's it. Morer. What could Avraham have answered the Manishtana? What do we answer the Manishtana? The boy asks questions. Why do we do contradictory things? We lean, that looks like freedom. We eat morer, that looks like slavery. We eat dip, that looks like freedom and luxury. We eat matzah, that looks like slavery. What's going on here? No problem, we say. There's a long story. That's how we start. Imagine the Seder of Avraham Avinu. There he comes, and there's moir on the table, and there's matzah on the table, and he dips and he does. The child starts asking Yitzchak. He was a pikeach Yitzchak. He can be quite sure. He asked the four questions. What's going on here? Matzah, it looks as if it's a Tisha B'Av today a little bit. Sort of a semi-Tisha B'Av. So why are we sitting on Tisha B'Av? We sit on low chairs. No, we say reclining like kings. We dip. That doesn't look like a Tisha B'Av. That's like kings eat. Moir. What's going on? What could Avraham have answered? Avodim ayinu lefarim Mitzrayim? No. Vayitzrinu Hashem biyad chazoko? No. Chachoik, it's a statute. That's the halacha, that's how it is. Don't know. Years later, what happens? Oh, now we understand why we were eating matzah and morer. Now we understand why we were reclining and why we were dipping. Now it makes sense. No longer a chok. So we see, says the Beis Halevi, that statutes, chukim, those laws that appeared not to have reasons, that's only a temporary thing. They don't have reasons now. But as history unfolds itself, we begin to find the reasons. Where? In the future. And that's the essence of Pesach, and that's the essence of our answer to the Rosh. Don't look for the reasons in the past. Look for the reasons in the future. That's the whole gearing of Yiddishkeit. Look towards the future and act now with the future in mind, not with the past in mind. We had a few shiurim ago, but we were advised in Pirkei Avos to know that there's an eye watching you, and there's an ear listening to you, and to know where you come from, where you're going to, and what's the ultimate, the most important part of it all. Mi at lifnei mi ato osid litein din v'cheshve. You've got to live with the awareness of before whom you're going to have to account for everything that you do. Live with your eye on the future and you'll live straight. That's the way to do it. Imagine you're driving a car down the road or teaching somebody to drive a lane, and he's looking out of the back window all the time, looking in his mirror all the time. But you'll have an accident very quickly. That's life. Where do you look? You've got to look far ahead, right down the road. I remember teaching my sister to drive, or trying to do it, and she couldn't keep straight. She couldn't do anything. I couldn't figure out what was she doing wrong. And eventually I found out there was a little mascot on the top of the bonnet. She was aligning the mascot, or trying to align the mascot with a white line in the middle of the road, and trying to keep straight by looking at the nose of her bonnet. It didn't take very long for me to tell you, but put your eye further, look down, and don't worry about what's right in front of you. You look down, right down the road, and you'll go straight. That's how it is. You want to understand the meaning, you want to understand the purpose, you want to understand where we're going, you have to look way down. And until you get there, sometimes you don't understand. It's later on that things start becoming clearer. People always ask, why the Holocaust? Such a difficult question. Of course, it's very often a rhetorical question. It's not always a question that needs an answer. But even then, sometimes it is. People ask, why? And what is the problem with that question? Because you're seeking the answer in the past. Don't seek the answer in the past. We might not have got to the answer yet. The answer is in the future. You're asking the same kind of question that Yitzchok must have asked his father at that Seder night. Why? And his father was flawed. Can't answer the question now. Wait, wait, wait a few hundred years and you'll find out why. That's how it is sometimes. We have to wait a long time to see things retrospectively becoming meaningful. So how do you act in the interim? How can we take decisions? How can we operate if meaning is only going to develop sometime in the future, maybe in centuries to come? How do I operate in the present? Halacha. That's why I need to be guided by somebody who can see that future. Then I can function. Comes the Ribbono Shel Olam and says, I know what the future is going to be. I'm telling you, this is what you do now. That's all you have to worry about. So is what we're doing a chok or is it mishpat? Is it something rational or irrational? It appears non-logical to us or non-rational to us because we can't see far enough. We haven't got the full context and therefore we can't see it in its proper place. But we are told to do it by a being who does see the full context. And as history unfolds itself, so things become meaningful, so one begins to understand what it is that's happening. Who could have explained in the time of the war why Hitler invaded Russia at that particular time instead of invading England? Who could have explained such a thing? Now, in retrospect, we know why. It was the Yad Hashem. It was the most absurd, insane thing to do. It was the Yad Hashem. That was the turning point of the war. But at the time, it just didn't seem to have any meaning at all. Nobody could understand. Things unfold. All sorts of things happen. I mentioned in one of the ladies' shiurim a story which I've told before of the Kovnarov who was implored by his daughter just before the war to come to England, I think it was, where they'd arranged a passport for him, they'd arranged passage for him, and they felt that he should come. Kovnarov, it's the Dvar Avrom. And he wrote a letter to his daughter, which still exists, where he said, I can't come because I'm too ill, I'm old and I'm ill, and I can't come. But don't think that I don't know that there's going to be a terrible Holocaust here. There will be a terrible Holocaust, and Jews will be wiped out, it will be a terrible tragedy. And that can be for one of two reasons. Either we're wicked, and this is our punishment, or we are righteous, and this is an atonement for the Jewish people. And my daughter, how will you know afterwards which of the two it is? You will watch. If soon after the Holocaust there is a major change in the status of the Jewish people, then you will know that we were righteous, and this was the atonement necessary to bring about that change. If after the Holocaust there will be no improvement in the status of the Jewish people, then you will know that we were wicked, and this was our punishment. Clear thinking, crystal clear thinking in the midst of all that blackness. And what happened after the Holocaust? Not just the state of Israel, that's part of it. But the whole status of the Jewish people in the Western world, we've enjoyed a kind of status that we haven't had since the time of Shlomo HaMelech, probably, when we had Eretz Israel proper. Where everything is open to Jews and possibilities, and Jews are making money all over, and they're being educated all over, they're living in peace, there hasn't been a pogrom for 40 years, for more than that, absolutely nothing. Jews living and flourishing throughout the Western world. It's unreal in terms of history. It's never been before. We take it all very for granted because we've never seen anything different. But if we just develop a bit of a historic perspective instead of a narrow perspective, we should wonder every day what's happening. Where's it all gone? Where's all the anti-Semitism? Where are all the pogroms? This is all a result of the atonement of those Kedoshim who gave their lives in the Holocaust. And the Ribbono Shel Olam must have been hoping that with this removal of pressure, that with this openness, with Eretz Yisrael being given back to us, it must have been the hope of the Ribbono Shel Olam that we would bring Mashiach. That the Jewish people would pull themselves together to such a height that they would raise themselves and improve themselves and perfect themselves to such levels that the Ribbono Shel Olam could have brought the Mashiach. That must have been the purpose of it. That must be the intention. Now, in retrospect, we see. Who knows at what point the Ribbono Shel Olam's patience runs out and says, no, I tried. 6 million people died in order to bring such a situation about, and they messed it up. They blew it. They had 40 years, 50 years, 60 years, who knows how much, of absolute ease and comfort. They had Eretz Yisrael. They had time. They had the economic environment. They had influence. They had whatever they needed. They could have turned the world around. They could have taught the entire world what Avodas Hashem is. They could have taught the entire world what morality and ethics is. Instead, what's happened to them? The world shows them up. Who knows at what point the Ribbono Shel Olam gives up, so to say, and says, that's it, I've tried. But that's the way we need to live, with an understanding that meaning is found in the future, not in the past. Why the Holocaust? If you're looking back and asking why the Holocaust, of course we can't always know the answer to that or many other questions. If we look forward, if we have enough perception, we might understand. And if we don't have enough perception, we might have to wait a while before we understand. That's the principle with which we answer the Rosha. You say you understand the Eidus, and you say you understand the Mishpatim. You only have a problem with the Avodah. Why do you have a problem with the Avodah? Because you're seeking the philosophy in the past, and you're saying that no longer applies. That's wrong. Seek the philosophy in the future. The cause is the mitzvah. The effect is Mitzrayim. Then you'll understand it properly, Rosh. So the Beis Halevi explains, we are in fact giving him an answer. We're answering the question very thoroughly with a very fundamental principle. Let's now go back to the Chochem. What does the Chochem say? Moha Eidus v'achukim v'amishpotim. What are the Eidus, Chukim, and Mishpotim? What does he mean? He's not classifying them as three separate things. He's classifying them and wants to know the connectedness between them. That in every mitzvah there is an element of Eidos, there's an element of Chok, there's an element of Mishpat. What are those elements? For example, now with the understanding of the analysis of the answer to the Rosha, we can understand the question of the Chochom a little more clearly. A Chok, what is a Chok? A chok is a formula, a religious formula given to us by the Ribbono Shel Olam, which appears not to make sense. That's a chok. But when you put the Eidos into it, what happens then? The Eidos is the story. So let's say Matzah as it used to be before Yetzias Mitzrayim, in the days of Avraham and of Yitzchak and Yaakov, Matzah was a chok. There were no Eidos to support it. There was no story. There was no background. There was no human dimension to support, to give meaning and to broaden out and color, paint in this formula. Then comes the story of Mitzrayim, we go into Egypt, we come out of Egypt, all of a sudden the mitzvahs of Pesach take on color. We begin to understand why matzah, why moru, what the relationship is to each other, why we do these contradictory things, all of a sudden it all becomes clear. So when you put the Eidos into the Chok, you're left with something which is a Mishpat, now it has logic. That's the relationship. If you isolate them, then you have an Eidos, a Chok, a Mishpat. But if you fuse the Eidos together with the Chok, if you fuse the story, the background, the history, the philosophy, together with a formula, then you have Mishpat. Then you have something balanced. Then you have something rational. Then you have something logical. And the Chochem asks, what is the Eidos, Chukim, and Mishpatim attached to this? What is this that he's referring to the Korban Pesach? And we answer him, Ein Maftir Nachar HaPesach Afikoyim. And here I want to use the Perush of the Netziv to understand this. And the Netziv says, Ein Maftir Nachar HaPesach Afikoyim. What does that mean? The din is that the Korban Pesach, as we said, has to be eaten at the end. It must be eaten when you're satisfied. You can't be hungry when you eat it. On the other hand, you can't be full when you eat it either. It can't be achil or gas. So it's got to be just right. When you eat the Korban Pesach, you've got to feel satisfied, but not full. Now, how often do you sit down at a Pesach table with a competent balabosta and get to the afikomen feeling just right? Doesn't happen. I always had groans around that. As it comes to afikomen, groans. Oh, you can't. And another whole kazayis. Does that mean as much as we had the first time again? Oh, you can't. That's not the way it's supposed to be. Why is it like that? Because we don't fulfill the mitzvah correctly. How do you fulfill that mitzvah? When do you fulfill the mitzvah of Ein Matir Achar HaPesach HaFikomen? When you start with a Knedlach already. And the Balabosta says, three Knedlach or four? You know, it's like the Juicy Lucy's. They don't ask you small, medium or large. They just say medium or large. And then that gives you the option. And that way they never sell smalls. So it is with the Knedlach. The Balabosta doesn't say, do you want Knedlach or not? She says, do you want three Knedlach or four Knedlach? So you've got to say one knedel, please. Why? Because Ein Maftir Achar HaPesach HaFikomen. I've got to get to the afikomen just right. And she puts the plate in front of you, and you say, please, this is a little too much. Do you mind if I leave, sir? No, she says, whatever it is. And you leave two spoons. Because you know exactly how much you can eat. You've been practicing, you know exactly how much you can eat in order to get right. No, really? We don't practice our halachas. It's funny. All other things we practice. All sorts of things that are difficult and that are tricky, we practice before we do them. Lulav and Esrog, very difficult to be menanea the lulav, to shake the lulav properly. Before Pesach, you should go and take a stick in the garden and a stone and hold them together and before Sukkot. You're right, before Pesach, take 6 months to get a garden. And you should take a stick and a stone in the garden and take a Mishnah Berurah and go through the halachas and practice and practice and practice. It's very tricky movements, wrist movements, very difficult to do it. There's no way if you haven't practiced it you're going to get it right. But we don't. Come Sukkot, we just flow into it as if it's all so easy. This Ein Maftir Achar HaPesach HaFikomen, you've got to know your capacity precisely. And it needs to be measured out. And then comes the next course, so there's probably been a Hadiv before that, and then comes the soup. And then comes the main course, and you've got to know exactly how much you can eat of each thing. And then the desserts, you've got to know exactly how much you can take, so that come the afikomen, you're feeling satisfied, but not full. Which means throughout the meal, one's mind is on the afikomen. What does that mean? Where's our mind? On the future. Everything we're doing is being analyzed in terms of the end. Figure out what's the end. Can I eat do I want three or four knedlach? Answer. What do we normally think? We look in the past and the present. How much have I eaten already? And how hungry am I? No, not on Seder night. We look ahead. How full am I going to be for the afikomen? That will determine whether I can have three knedlach or four or one knedl. That's what determines it. The whole training of that meal is that everything we eat that evening is thought about, weighed up, balanced, measured, in terms of the end of the meal. That's what we teach the Chochem. But the Tzid learns it slightly differently. He learns that this is the Kerach of Torah, that a mitzvah applies only at the time of the mitzvah itself. Shake your lulav and esrog on Sukkot, and you eat your matzah on Pesach. Pesach's over, matzah's over. That's the end of the story. Shabbos is Shabbos. Sunday is a different day already. The laws of Shabbos don't apply anymore. But Torah learning is that which keeps one occupied with the mitzvahs in between the mitzvahs. Because Torah is an ongoing thing, especially if one's learning with intellectual depth, then 24 hours a day your mind is involved. So that this constancy of thinking in mitzvahs can only be achieved through deep Torah learning. And the Tziv says that's what we tell the Chochem. That just as during the whole Seuda, because we're calculating, we're thinking therefore throughout the meal, we're thinking about the afikomen, so all the time we think in Torah, and that's the reason for Torah. I'm taking a slightly different line. That what we're teaching him is all the time, that the principle of life is, don't think that the afikomen is the end. That's at the end of the meal, now we've got to worry about afikomen. No. Afikomen is at the end, but your mind has to be there on that from the beginning. Seif maise, b'machshova tchilu, we say in the Lecha Dodi. That the final action has to be at the forefront of the mind. When you're thinking, when you're planning, that the end has to be in front, in the mind. When an architect is commissioned to design a building, what does he start with? What's his first concept? What is the building going to be used for in the end? That's where he starts. Then he goes back to the beginning, and all the time, if he's a good architect, all the time he's thinking about the end. How will this fit with the use of the building? Sometimes you find architects that design the most magnificent buildings, And that is totally impractical. They don't work. They look nice and they're expensive and all sorts of things. But they just don't work. They don't do what they were meant to do. Because he got carried away. And in the middle, he took his mind off the end. That's the principle we teach the Chacham. Throughout life, we have to realize that the cause is in the future. The cause of our being in this world is the Olam Haba, is after death. That's the cause, that's not the result. That the reason we're here is in order to be able to face the Ribbono Shel Olam afterwards. That's why we're here. Everything we do is measured and evaluated in terms of something yet to come. That's how one can understand meaning. And that really is why we do so many odd and absurd things in order to stimulate questions. Normally one thinks that the question is the cause and the answer is the consequence. I ask a question and I get an answer. Here we're doing the opposite. We are providing, we're doing things to arouse questions. And one has to realize that the oddity that one questioned was the cause. By that I mean that there's a certain arrogance in questioning and in answering. One questions and one thinks from the answer one has discovered all sorts of wonderful things. So there old Newton sitting under the apple tree. I don't know if it was an apple tree or not, and I don't know if Newton ever did, if the story is true, but it's a nice story. He's sitting under the apple tree, the apple falls down on his head. Asks Newton, why does the apple fall down and it doesn't fly up? Oh, gravity. Aren't I wonderful? Discovered gravity. What he doesn't realize is the reason that apple fell on your head was in order you should ask the question. But Ribbono Shel Olam was trying to get you to ask the question. It's not I discovered gravity. Gravity was put there in order that you should ask, why do apples fall down? That was there. It was put there in order that you should discover it. And that discovery is only the beginning of all sorts of other things. So it is. Moshe Rabbeinu comes and he sees the burning bush. Why is the bush burning and it's not affecting the leaves? The leaves remain green. Oh, Ribbono Shel Olam's there. He realizes that the burning bush was there in order that he should ask the question. And the question led him into communication with Ribbono Shel Olam. And as I mentioned in the ladies' shiur this morning, all too often we allow opportunities to question to pass us. We don't question either because we're not perceptive or because we're not curious or because we're not intelligent or for whatever reason. We don't question. And we don't realize that there are hundreds of burning bushes. Imagine had Moshe not been curious. Had he driven past and said, ah, another felt fire. On. and that was it. He stops. And I did a survey among the ladies. I asked them how many of them had ever stopped when they'd seen a felt fire to see if the grass is really burning or if it stays green while it's burning. Not one of them did. Not one of them had ever stopped to have a look. That means had they passed that burning bush in Mitzrayim, they wouldn't have noticed. And we wouldn't have got out of Egypt. And there wouldn't have been a Torah. And there wouldn't have been anything. Because they don't look at burning bushes. I won't ask the question here where the men are present too, because I'm sure the men would always look at these things. It must be. And so it is with all the curiosities in life. Curious things happen in order that we should ask the questions. And if we don't, we're missing out. When there's something odd, that should alert you. That's a bell ringing. When there's something odd, you should say, oh, there's something here. Something's going on here. I've got to find out. This is the Ribbono Shel Olam communicating with me. I don't know what he's saying yet, but there's something absurd in a world which is supposed to be rational. That means something needs investigation. It's like these people that search for gold and they've got an instrument and they walk up and down and up and down. All of a sudden the instrument starts going wild. Oh, they get all excited. Must be gold here. You say, where? No, they say, we don't know where. It might be miles down, but there's gold here. They know. So it is with us too. When we see something odd, when we see something that demands a question, that's the instrument going crazy. Oh, there's gold here. There's something important here. That's what we train ourselves in our learning. In our Gemara, you see an odd Rashi, see a strange Tosfos, you see a question in the Gemara, it doesn't look right. The moment you see something odd, your heart starts beating, the pulse starts going, you're close to a discovery. Something's happening here, this isn't normal, something's happening here. There's a chidush, because if things were the way they were supposed to be, there would be nothing odd. That means there's a new discovery which is about to take place. The apple has fallen on the head, we've just got to ask the question properly, we've got to formulate the question, and we've got to find the answer. And so it is with life. In every area, We did in the ladies' shoe this morning a beautiful story of Rabbi Yochanan walking down the road and seeing a man picking figs, but he was picking the green ones and leaving the ripe ones. So there again, I asked, what would happen if we walked down the road and saw a man picking figs? Firstly, we probably wouldn't even notice the man picking figs because we're busy planning our next step or this or that, or worrying about our aches and pains, and we probably wouldn't even notice that the man was picking figs. And if we did notice that he was picking figs, we probably wouldn't notice that he was picking the ripe ones and picking the green ones and leaving the ripe ones. And if we were really so perceptive and so curious that we tucked and noticed it, we would scratch our heads and walk on. Rabbi Yochanan didn't. He stopped and asked. Got excited. This is interesting. This is fascinating. This is a man doing something odd. A rational man, apparently, doing something odd. Perhaps one of the reasons that we don't get excited when we see odd things is because there's hardly anything normal in it. So odd things have become absolutely normal. It was like America is one of the crazy places of the world. And the further west you go in America, the more crazy it gets. And the craziest place of all is along the beach of Los Angeles, which is as far west as you can go before you come to the far east. And there you find the meshuganas that you can't imagine what meshuganas you find. But they are fascinating. I've spoken about them so many times before, these meshuganas. And I remember once I had to go to my brother's shul on Shabbos morning. I didn't have my talis, so I wore my talis to shul. I walked to shul with my talis flapping in the breeze, all these meshuganas up and down the road. I didn't know what they would do to me. They greeted me friendly. I wanted to shake hands and wave at me. Very friendly. Davin left my talis in shul. Walked back. Everybody looking at me, odd. So I said to my brother, I don't understand. I walked to shul with my talis flapping in the wind and all these goyim are very friendly. I come home dressed ordinarily and they look at me as if I'm from outer space. He says, sure, the talis flapping, you're as mad as them. You fit in. But now you walk with a suit and tie. They've never seen anything like that before. You look odd. So perhaps part of the reason that we don't stop to look at curious things is because so many things are curious without good reason. But when you're dealing with irrational people, if a rational person does something curious, stop and ask. It's fascinating. Why is he doing it? What's behind it? And all sorts of richness results from that. But there has to be openness, there has to be communication, there has to be curiosity. One has to be relaxed enough to enter into dialogue with a stranger and question him as to why he says what he says or does what he does. But if one does that, what richness is available to a person? That's the art of questioning, to realize that the fact that nothing in the world is a coincidence applies to us personally too. It's not just to society and to history on a grand scale of things. We know that when there's a major thing in history, there's a world war, chas v'shalom, or the state of Israel is established, we're very quick to say, nothing's coincidence, Yad Hashem, everything's Yad Hashem. But that goes right down to our day-to-day individual lives. And if Hashem exposes us to something odd, there's a reason for it. And if we ask the question, we've got to know that the oddness is because of the question. That the question, the Ribbono Shel Olam created the oddness, or exposed us to that oddness, in order that we should question it and learn something from it, find out something, what it's all about. And so in Pesach too, we do all these odd things to encourage the questions, not only of the children, but to enter a questioning frame of mind. So that the whole dialogue of teaching and learning of the Higadot Lebincho Vayomahu, the mitzvah is to teach. And in order to teach, there needs to be questions. In order to be questions, there needs to be alertness. There needs to be curiosity. There needs to be a desire to notice that the apple has fallen downwards instead of upwards. To have the courage to confront the issue, to define it, to ask the question, and to seek relentlessly for a satisfying answer.